have youth worship this morning, but Angie had to be gone there at the last minute, so everybody's going to be stuck with me. Is that the right way to say it? We're going to do something. I'm going to change things just a hair because of that. But anyways, we're talking about the Gospels. I figured that anybody can talk about the Gospels. We've been going all this year through books of the Bible each month, a different book of the Bible. Since January, it's October, we're doing okay, we're going to make it, but we did up the ante a little bit. If you weren't here last week, the month of October, rather than focus on a book of the Bible, we're going to focus on the Gospels. And so we're going to do a different Gospel each week. Now, those of you who are super smart know that there's 5 Sundays in October, and so you're wondering, so we have a surprise. I don't know what we're going to do the 5th Sunday, but we'll see. So we started last week with Matthew. And in a lot of ways, Matthew is a good place to start because it's, you know, the first one. So we started with the first one. And we noticed that Matthew was kind of like our old Jewish uncle who shows up at the family reunions and says, hey, let's take a look at family pictures. And so he just starts the very beginning of the gospel showing how all of these old people that know, you know, little teenagers in the audience are going, come on, Matthew, let's get away. But he's trying to connect Jesus through the Jewishness of Jesus. He's trying to make the case to fellow Jews that, hey, he's legit. And so we talked about the Mount Rushmore of leaders that Matthew works hard to connect Jesus to. Today we turn to Mark, and Mark is a different cat altogether. Most people can figure out pretty quickly that Mark is the shortest of the 4 Gospels. Which means the sermon will be shortest, right? Wrong, right? We have to make it up a little bit. So Mark is the shortest. It's also the oldest. So it's mostly, almost universally held. Mark is the oldest of the Gospels, and that Mark was around when Matthew and Luke were writing, and they rely pretty heavily on Mark. Now, if Matthew is like Facebook, Mark is like Twitter. Like, he just kind of puts these little 140-character stories out there and just moves on. Mark doesn't pontificate very much at all. He's like the opposite of John. John is like a blogger. Mark is like Twitter, right? He just kind of tells you what happens and off he goes. John writes pages and pages about what it all means and all these kinds of things. And we see it from the very beginning of the gospel. So when you open up to Mark chapter 1, he's pretty much going to get right to business. Remember, Matthew starts one verse talking about how Jesus is connected to David and to Abraham, and then off with the genealogy. Mark is different. Mark says the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Matthew kind of builds up to his point. Mark kind of lets it known right away. Hey, this guy that I'm going to write about, he's the Son of God, just in case anybody was wondering. It's written in the prophet Isaiah, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way, a voice of one calling in the desert. Prepare the way of the Lord, make straight paths for him. So John came along, baptizing in the desert region, preaching a baptism of repentance for forgiveness of sins. The whole Judean countryside and all the people of Jerusalem went out to him, confessing their sins. They were baptized by him in the Jordan River. John wore clothing made of camel's hair with a leather belt around his waist, and he ate locusts and wild honey. And this was his message. After me, one will come more powerful than I am, the thongs of whose sandals I'm not worthy to stoop down and untie. I baptize you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit. And then off he goes. We don't have quite time to read through the whole gospel this morning. I guess we could, but we'll just kind of summarize it a little bit. But then if you just kind of follow, if you have like a newer translation, they do a fine job of subtitling it for us. And you can just look at how quickly we move through the story. The baptism and temptation of Jesus, the calling of the disciples. He drives out evil spirits, heals many, prays for in a solitary place. He heals a man with leprosy. He heals a paralytic. And off we're going to the races of what the story of Jesus is about. Happens much more quickly in Mark than any of the other stories. He has a story to tell about this Jesus Christ who came along. And he wants to make sure that the audience gets the story. Now, last week we made a big point of talking about, if you're going to study all 4 Gospels, it on the surface may seem a little redundant, like, okay, we're going to do the same thing over again 4 times. Those of us who have read the Gospels enough realize that, no, actually, each one is kind of unique. It's kind of like having 4 children in a family, And if you ask each grown child what it was like growing up, more than likely each of the four is going to tell a pretty different story. I guarantee my brother and sister and I have a different story of how it was that we were raised and how things were at our house growing up. And these aren't Jesus' children, but they're his close disciples. And it's kind of the same way. They're kind of telling a story in their own experience, but it's beyond their own experience. It's also they have an agenda to tell because they're telling it to different people. And so last week we talked about how Matthew was really Jewish and his focus was on the real devout Jews who were trying to make sense of how this Jesus fulfilled prophecies that they've been told for generations. There just seemed to be a disconnect from them. Mark does something different. Mark's audience is related. They seem to be mostly Jewish, but there was something different going on. And so in order to fully grasp, I think, the message of Mark, we really need to grasp his audience. And in order to grasp his audience, we're going to start with our audience today. And so we don't have time to do this individually, so you're going to be stuck hearing about my boring week. But I want you to think about your week. It's Sunday. It's time to look ahead to a new week, but it's also the bookend of another week. And so just think about now going back the last week, back to Monday. We'll skip Sunday. Last Monday, what were you doing on Monday? How was your Monday? Was it mundane? My Monday was mundane. I was up at the office for about a half a day, and my grass was out of control, and so I went home and mowed my grass. How exciting was that? Then we attended a soccer game, Cecilia's last soccer game of the year. Did you win? No. Did you score? I don't think so. Did we? No. We did score a couple goals throughout the year, but Monday was not one of those days. So we had the year-end of soccer, putting the bookend on one season. Let's see, let's move forward to Tuesday. Tuesday looked a lot like Monday for me. Was up here for a while, changed the afternoon plans, changed a little bit. My wife and I had a date. You remember that? Remember that? That was a little Quaker steak and lube. Their lunch buffet is fantastic. Had some wings. We went to bought some flowers to dress up the house a little bit, planted flowers. Then I had to go to a football meeting, my last football meeting of the year as an official. We went and watched film for an hour at St. Charles High School until about 9 o'clock at night. Wasn't this exciting for everybody? Ray would have enjoyed this, right? Was pretty funny, though. We watched a clip about an official who missed a roughing the holder call. How exciting is that, Jackie? Not so much. Wednesday, isn't this just an exciting thing, learning about Adam's week here? What did we do on Wednesday? Wednesday, I was at the office for a long time. We had lunch, Val, Deb, we had a fine lunch on Wednesday. We had friends over for dinner that night, it was nice. Opened to grill, Mary Beth doesn't want me to tell the story, opened to grill, a mouse had built a nest in our grill at some point, and I was faced with the moral dilemma of what to do with this. It was in there. It wasn't just there was a mouse in my grill, and I knew two ways this could go down. One of them was not so good. I did walk away for a little while. The mouse got out. Everything was good. We had a lovely dinner. Thursday, I had a lot going on Thursday, a lot of planning and things, preparations for some things that are coming up. Had to get a lot done because of what time did we leave? Clark, what time did we leave? Clark and I and Cameron headed to Cleveland. We watched a baseball game, which was exciting in Cleveland. We took the train. What time did we get home, Cameron? It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, right? 3 o'clock in the morning. Clark, what time did we get up on Friday morning? 6:30. For 3.5 hours of sleep, all right. So Friday, come back in to the office. You can tell I worked really hard on the sermon. I'm like, I'll just recount my week. This is awesome. I got to go. I have a football game down in Miami Trace, so I left for that at about 4 o'clock. I told the guys, I slept for 3 hours. I'm not going to throw a single penalty in this game. It's just going to be a real quick game. I got home about, 11:30, something like that. Tuesday night, we had a softball game. I forgot about Tuesday night. Why didn't you speak up, Clementine, to say, I had a softball game? Oh, I'm sorry. Softball game Tuesday night. Softball game yesterday. We finished soccer. We finished softball. Finished baseball, just a couple football games left. What does this have to do with anything? I don't know. I just had to fill some time. Just kidding. I was planning this sermon, and I thought this is going to it's going to be a really serious sermon. I didn't really intend for it to be, but I think when you read the Gospels, you're confronted with something. Now, I don't expect that your week was like mine. If you have kids, then probably it was. It was probably similar to what mine was. But I don't care about my week. I want you to think about your week. You know, you went to work, you spent time with your family, you did whatever you do, you go through the routines, you're watching the news this week, which has been certainly entertaining all along the week, and all the media outlets that blow up, and all this stuff. And then you sit down and you read, all right, we're gonna study Mark in church on Sunday. The beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's how the gospel begins. And you think about the week that I just laid out for you, which was pretty boring, pretty mundane, pretty distracting. And I'm guessing that if you're like me, you have difficulty sometimes connecting the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, to soccer practice, or to going to the mall, or going to the grocery store, or making dinner one night, or talking to your friends and family, or watching a movie or a television show, or just whatever it is that makes up life, so often seems disconnected from what we do here. And so sometimes it can be maybe we may have a tendency to just come in and feel like we're going to just do our spiritual thing, and feel better about ourselves, and then go back to that hamster wheel of life. And there's like this just general disconnect from the things that we're going to read this morning in Mark, in my boring old life this week. And I'm a minister, so I'm guessing that I would have a little bit easier time trying to make it sound spiritual some kind, right? Well, I was up here and prayed for 3 hours for each one of you on Monday. On Tuesday, I read the Gospels front and back. At least I could probably do that, but I'm guessing if I'm struggling having my spiritual understanding of life, that you probably are too. Now, this is where we start to have a real challenge before us in what we're about to do. I want the teens to come up. If you're 6th, 12th grade, come up here. I think I need a few extras too. But come on up here. We're going to do it today. Hey, Brian, do you have your mic? Will you send it up with Brian, please? I mean, with Ben. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's see, I need a couple others. Anybody? I need 4 more, I think. I need 10 people. Jordan, come on up. Any visitors are more than welcome. Any old people are more than welcome. We do want to... Anybody else want to come up here? I'll pick you. Clementine, you want to come up? Celia, you want to come up? This may be a terrible idea. I don't know yet. 1, 2, 3, 4. That's fine. We'll go with order. Okay, so, Bailey, you want to come up? All right. All right, I'm going to have to look at these carefully before I send these out. You're going to see what I'm... Remember, they weren't supposed to be in here, the younger kids. So I'm struggling. I was struggling this week with the message and the radical nature of what I read in Scripture, right? And it's not just Mark. It's all the way through. But since we're focused on the Gospels right now, I'm struggling with the life that I live every week, and how does the radical nature of what the Gospels are teaching connect to my life? And I started thinking about some people. And so I want you guys to hold up these pictures. And there's a story in the back that we're going to have you read in just a second. So you do this one. You do this one. We'll give this to an older kid. Maybe. I don't remember exactly what's all on them, so do this one. Do this one, Jordan. We won't do that one. We won't do this one. Sorry, I'm gonna proof this before I give it to him. Okay, this might be kind of hard to read. I'll help you with that one. But just hold the picture up. Hold the picture up. Hold the picture up. Okay, I changed my mind. I don't. Who? You don't have one? I'm not going to give you one of these. You can go back and sit down. Sorry. I'm sorry. Who else didn't have one? Luke. Sorry. Sorry. Get out of here. Sorry. Sorry. I had to on the fly edit these a little bit. Because what we're going to talk about for about 5 minutes is the fact that we got up this morning, and you know, there's been all kind of political news, and it's just been rancorous all weekend. and it sucks everybody in. But the fact of the matter is there are Christians all over the world who have such a different experience than we do. And I feel like it's incumbent upon all of us to just stop once in a while and remember that. That we get to come up to church and we have fun with our kids and we laugh and the preacher tells jokes and we have fun and we go back to our lives, which according to my life is pretty mundane. It's not really life-changing. It just sounds just pretty boring. But these guys are holding pictures up right now of people who did exactly what we do. But their experience was very different. And so, Ben, why don't you start? Man, how bad is that one? I don't remember. It's rough, isn't it? Go for it. Just go for it. Here's the thing. Before I do this. For about a month now, everybody's been all mad and throwing a huge fit about what Colin Kaepernick during the before a football game, when it comes to the flag. And I was sitting before communion, and Clementine had laid down, and I was making her stand up, or sit up. And she's tired, and I thought about that, and I thought, you know, isn't it funny? We'll make such a big deal about things like that. And then we come to church, and we just kind of go through the motions, and I don't ever hear anybody get that fired up about how things go down here. And then I saw these pictures, and it took me a while to do this. It took me a couple hours to get these stories all collected. And hopefully it has the impact on you that it did with me. So, Ben, if you'll read this, please. What, the name is on the front, so you may have to read. Yeah, if, the best you can. Jagermeister, I think is. Yeah. Yeah. That works. Oh, wait, that's the wrong one. Does it get the pictures are wrong and the stories are wrong?
Yeah.
Romero's over here. What, who did this? who's the pre? Yeah, right. You'd have one job this week to do these, and you got all mixed up. Jeez. All right, so who's got Jagermeister from Austria? Anybody, maybe it's on one of these. All right, read this one. We'll get it there one way or another. So he conscientiously objected to serving for the Nazis, but he offered to be a paramedic. They refused. He was executed by a guillotine in the 1940s. You have the picture of the Elliots. Who has a picture of the Elliots? Somebody, because that's the one you had. Yeah, Clark has this one, so that was on yours. So read about the Elliots. If you've seen the movie End of Spear, I think this is what it's about. All right, Elizabeth Reed, this is the one you have, I think. What's her name? Yeah, that one's it. Read her name. Mm-hmm. Sure. Who has Martin Burnham? You do. Read about Martin. All of you just go ahead and hold those up for a minute. I want everybody to just look at those. Look at the pictures here. And just consider that all these people died for their faith. Samuel's actually holding the picture of the priest in France who was killed just back in June. Some Islamic militants came in church building on a Tuesday morning during Mass, just approached him and stabbed him in the neck, killed him. You guys want to just set these down on the communion table and you can go back to your seats. Let's go ahead and set them down there. Yeah, we're not going to read. We won't read through them all. Take that back to your dad. It's always interesting, week in and week out. I never know kind of the direction the sermons will head, especially this year as we've studied a book of the Bible. Felt like it would be a little bit more straightforward when you pick the books ahead of time. But before we go any further, let's consider the audience for the Gospel of Mark. Because this audience that I'm a part of, it is just so hard for us to get what Jesus is teaching and what Mark is trying to say. It was on the evening of July the 18th and into the dawn of July 19th in 64 in Rome. Now, the Roman Empire is kicking right now, right? It's growing, it's building, it's this just most powerful empire the world has ever known to this point. And on that evening, there's a fire that starts near the Circus Maximus. It's one of the largest outdoor arenas in the world. Some people think it held as many as 150,000 people. And outside of it was this really popular marketplace. Maybe like the Short North or maybe the North Market if it wasn't inside, where there's all these vendors packed in close together and there's shops and there's no real building structures. It's just all kind of temporary. And at some point in the middle of the night, a fire started. And all these thousands of years later, it's still kind of controversial how exactly the fire started. Was it set? Most people think that it was. And if it was, who set it? Now, it was kind of the combination of a lot of terrible things. The fire started, it was a really windy night, the wind started blowing the embers towards the city, and it started a horrific fire. It burned out almost every one of the districts of Rome. Some of them were burned out and couldn't be rebuilt. It burned for a week, and they thought they had finally kind of contained it, and then it would fuel up again because of the wind. Now, there was this rumor that started that the Emperor Nero had actually started the fire, kind of did it on his own and created this situation. And whether that happened or not, it's still controversial, but what we do know is that people began to believe that. And so what Nero did was he needed a scapegoat because he was taking all kinds of political flap. You can imagine some kind of rumor gets started or some tape unearthed from years ago how that might cause some political problems. And so it happens for Nero, and he starts to begin to blame this new group of people who are emerging, known as the Christians. Some people may still believe that the Christians were to blame, but most people think that it was just it was under the guise of trying to save Nero's career that he begins to blame Christians. And so there's an ancient writer whose name is Tacitus who writes about the situation that happened at this time. He says that neither human resources nor imperial munificence nor appeasement to the gods eliminated sinister suspicions that the fire had been instigated. To suppress the rumor, Nero fabricated scapegoats and punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians, as they were so popularly called. First, Nero had self-acknowledged Christians arrested. Then, on their information, large numbers of their others were condemned. Not so much for incendiarism as much as for information, large numbers were condemned, as much as for their antisocial tendencies. Sorry. Their deaths were made farcical. They didn't just kill them, but they made a fancy of them. They dressed them in wild animal skin, and they were torn to pieces by dogs, or crucified, or they were made into torches to be ignited after dark in substitute for daylight. Nero provides his gardens for the spectacle and exhibits displays in the circus at which he mingled in the crowd or stood in a chariot dressed as a charioteer. Despite their guilt as Christians and the ruthless punishment it deserved, the victims were actually pitied because it was felt as though they were being sacrificed into one man's brutality rather than to the interest of the nation. He's saying their punishment was so severe that people actually felt like, hey, should we do this? And so obviously, the Christians were scared to death, and they start running and hiding, and they're worried about what's going to happen. They're worried about their church. They're worried about their families. And it is this situation that Mark sets down to write his story. Because a generation had passed since the death of Christ. Stories were beginning to get mingled and contorted, and some were half true, and some were partially true, and some they didn't know. And so Mark sets out to make sure that there's some definitive statement about what actually Jesus was about. And if you're about to die because of your association with that man, you want to be pretty sure that he was the one that you think he was. And so for us to sit down today and read the Gospel of Mark, it's not going to give us the same emotion that it gave those people and the people that are scattered now on our communion table. If it's a matter of convenience, if it's a matter of showing up and getting up early on Sunday mornings to get to church, you know, that's one thing. But if it's your life that's at stake because people are coming after you because of your association, and then you open up and you read about Jesus being with the wild animals in the wilderness, in Mark 1, verse 13, it's the only place of the four Gospels where he's said to be with the animals. And it's probably because those early Christians who were hiding knew what it was like to be in the wilderness, to be with animals. When Jesus is falsely accused and misrepresented, the people who were being chased down for their faith could understand and empathize with Jesus. I know what it's like when somebody says something false against me. I know what it's like to have my neighbor betray me who I thought I could trust. When Judas betrays Jesus, the Christians are saying, I know what that's like. They had people that they went to church with in their gatherings that had betrayed them. They had people whose faces were in their minds when they're reading the stories in Mark. Jesus' followers throughout the Gospels seem to be caught between wanting to stay and be with Jesus, and yet wanting to flee to an easier life that didn't have so much potential for harm. When Jesus says in Mark 8, verse 34, and then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, if anybody would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? They didn't read that and think, well, that would sound like a cool bumper sticker. They didn't read that and think, I wonder how I could, make people think that I'm a good person. The people that were reading Mark in the first instance were saying, I think he might be like talking to me and saying that if I don't follow him, I'm going to give up everything. But it seems like to follow him, I'm going to have to give up everything. And they're caught in this conundrum. Mark doesn't battle or back away from the challenge that the church was providing to Rome, that there was conflict politically, and he doesn't back it down. When somebody asks Jesus about taxes, he says, just give to Caesar what's Caesar's. Give to God what's God's. The story of Jesus' crucifixion as told by Mark is a story about Rome's power versus the power of the kingdom. And when you're getting guns pointed at you, okay, it wasn't guns, right? When you're getting faced with death and persecution, it's not a hypothetical situation. Well, what exactly was going down? No, they needed reassurance that what Jesus suffered on the cross was for the cause of something that was more powerful than Rome itself. And so it is the pivotal moment in Mark at the end of the book in chapter 15. In verse 38, the curtain of the temple was torn from top to bottom. And it's the centurion in Mark's telling, the Roman centurion, who stands in front of Jesus, hears his cry, and says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." You see, the Gospel of Mark begins with the declaration that this is the Son of God, and now I'm going to show you how and show you what it means. And off he goes with this long tale of quick Twitter feed moments about what Jesus does in his life. And then at the end, it's this great kind of upside-down moment when it's the Roman centurion, of all people, that's standing there testifying to what he's seen. What a blessing it is to be able to come and gather on Sundays. What a blessing it is to sing songs and share prayers together, to get in our cars and most of us drive across town and assemble on this building, and none of us worries about persecution, and none of us worries about what the different things that fell to these people. But don't you see that amidst those blessings, we lose something when we read the Gospels? We lose something. Because when you're reading through this, at some moment, you have to have this feeling inside of you that says, this is pretty serious stuff. Like, this is serious stuff. Like all the stuff that we get caught up about. I mean, I had to go to the grocery store last night. They're on the radio, you know, talking about the Buckeyes game. And all the stuff that just we get so impassioned about. You read the Gospels, and the Gospel writers say, what are you doing? What are you caught up in all this stuff about? Like, this is life, and Jesus doesn't want to downplay the experiences that we have in life. What he wants to do is remind us time and time again of what really matters. And it's really only something that each of us can ask and answer for ourselves. Because we have to ask ourselves the same questions and the same things that the writer of Mark presented to the people who are reading. If this is Jesus, and this Jesus is God, if he really is the Son of God, then what does that mean to us in our lives? What does a commitment to him look like? I mean, for people who were brought face to face with their death, what did it mean to them? And we can talk hypothetically, and maybe in the history of all of our lives sitting in here this morning, it's maybe more real than it's ever been because of how close some of these martyrs have gotten to the Western world, to our own country. And so maybe it's time for us to start asking the difficult questions instead of what are we going to do to respond to bomb them. Jesus didn't call us to kill anybody for his sake. And so maybe it's time that we start asking the real question and asking it of our children and asking it of ourselves and of our churches. Would we die for him? That's what the whole story of Mark is. And if we try to make it anything else, we cheapen it, because there's no cheap way to say that. There's no soft way to say that. Would you die for him? And so when you come to the end of the story, it's fascinating how Mark ends his story. There's an addendum to the story. If you have your Bibles, you can probably see. I know mine has kind of a line across it after chapter 8, where that's the original ending. And it was so abrupt, and it was so kind of surprising, that later on, scribes said, we got to kind of touch this up a little bit. This is a little bit different. It's different than the way the other Gospels end. But if you follow the argument, or you follow the story as we followed it this morning, we're not surprised. Mark's is the shortest gospel, and it, in a lot of ways, is the most provocative. He lays out the case, basically asking the readers, are you ready to die for them? And for us, it's more hypothetical. For us, it's kind of imaginary. But for the people reading this the first time, boy, they're facing with some really, really challenging things. And the story ends with simply verse 8, trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And it's like that same experience that we all have as we come to the end of the gospel. And there's like two questions that are crying out for our answer. And they're abrupt, and they're quick, and they're to the point. And that is, do you believe that Jesus is the Messiah? Do you believe he's the one that's in charge of everything? Yes or no? And then the follow-up is, does it matter? Does it really matter to the way you live your life Monday and Tuesday and Thursday and Friday and Saturday and Sunday? That's just the way it ends. And it ends that way because there's only one way that you can answer that question. You have to do it yourself. I'd invite you to stand up and sing with us this final song.